Okay. So last week we talked about, I think, David's empire, right? Like the overnight empire, and the fact that the Navi did not seem particularly interested in David's like massive conquest. Any other story in history about somebody going from being a nothing, a shepherd, to a fugitive, to a small king, to an empire, an emperor? That would have been like, the climax. That would have been the end of the story, would be finally defeating all of their enemies that they've been battling for generations. But the Navi was not particularly interested in that at all. In fact, we saw that the battles themselves were totally skipped over. We saw the Perek in Tehillim, where David describes the tremendous struggle that he has in dealing with Aram and dealing with Edom and the other enemies on the other side of the Jordan River. And yet, if you would have just seen the Perek from last week, boom, 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 everything easy as pie. I thought the message back the last week was the Navi is telling us, do not focus on David becoming an emperor. Where David's heart lies is not in military success and conquest. David's heart lies in the ultimate vision of building the base of Mikdash. And the whole purpose of all these battles is, at least for David's perspective, is peace and security, number one. Number two, achieving gaining the spoils and the material which is necessary to ultimately build the base of Mikdash in a time of peace. That's where David's heart lies. David's heart does not lie in the world of battle. We're going to see that again this week. We're going to really see this week and next week that David's heart very, very much lies in the world of Chesed. We're going to see David's interactions with Mephibosheth this week, and then we're going to see another parak next week where David seems like a radical personality of Chesed. All that's going to do, it's going to make us wonder, so how on earth can David do the sins he does with Bathsheba and with Uriah? But that's going to be the theme this week. So load up the screen share. Okay, fine. And let's get started. So the Navi tells us that David asks, so David. So David asks, there's somebody I want to do chesed for someone. Is Ramah left from the house of Shaul? I want to do chesed because of Yehonasan. Now, right away, we need to ask, what is taking so long, right? When is this happening? I mean, David already has been king for a while. We said last week that even though the Navi described David winning all those battles as if it happened in a matter of minutes, it's clear from elsewhere in Tanakh that it took years for all of those victories to elapse. So David has been king for how many years exactly? And he's finally now waking up and saying to himself, oh, wait a second. I remember my old, best friend in the history of best friends that Chazal described as the greatest friendship of all time. And we had a promise that we would take care of each other's families. And like only now does he realize and remember, oh, I should find out if something is happening. It's a very strange thing for David to be saying. It's also strange that David doesn't know where any of Shaul's descendants are. What do you mean? Achdiyesh od nosar lebe Shaul. He doesn't know anything. Like where are Shaul's descendants that David has to ask any of this? So the Malbim relates to a piece of this. The Malbim says, right? One explanation. The reason why David doesn't know where Shaul's children are is that Shaul's children, or at least the one surviving child we know about here, is a fugitive. Why would that be? So the album says, How can David possibly not know? He lived, he's a son-in-law. It's easy for us to forget. But not only did David have a close relationship with Shaul once upon a time and a close friendship with Yehonasan, they're family. I mean, he lived in the palace, right? This guy, he's Yonasan's brother-in-law. Any children Yonasan has or his nephews, of course he knows who they are. So what exactly is going on? So the Malbim explains that what's happening here is that at the time when David becomes victorious, right? David, after the 7 years between David and Ishbosheth, David ends up on top. They were afraid that David would kill them. Why do they think that? Because that's what every king does. The ancient kings would kill even their brothers lest they rebel. not only ancient kings, by the way, in the Ottoman Empire, the Sultan, so, you know, the Sultan would have God knows how many wives in the harem. And so you have, you know, 50, Osama bin Laden is not the first person, right, to have like 50 kids. That's what they would do. One prince would become the next Sultan. And then the first thing you do when you become Sultan is you send messengers to kill every single one of your brothers. And the minhag was they did it with a silken thread. So they'd strangle their brothers to death, but at least it would be soft as they were killing their brothers. That's the standard way that many, many, I don't know, Middle Eastern rulers have operated from time immemorial until only a couple of hundred years ago, right? David's on top, so he's going to root out any opposition. And in a normal situation, it will make a lot of sense for them to go into hiding, and that's exactly what they do. So the Malbim says, "Hischabu kol yamim ad shekosam lo no doubt." They go into hiding, and David doesn't even know where they are. Right? That's how the Malbim understands what is happening over here. David wants to do chesed. He doesn't know about any of the surviving relatives because they've gone into hiding. Now, we need to wonder, okay, so that answers the first one of our questions. Why does David not know about any of Shaul's relatives? But the second thing we need to ask is, like, when exactly is this happening? So, you know, if we, didn't have this over here, but I think, I'm not sure, but definitely the Dat Mikra, so the modern Mepharshim, assume that this parak pretty clearly has to be written out of order. This parak about David wondering where Mephibosheth could be, there's no way that it's happened, 20, 30 years into David's reign. I think it's the Dat Mikra which says, you know, if we think about it, the minute that David becomes king of the unified Eretz Yisrael, so he goes to Yerushalayim, and remember, the minute that happens, the Plishtim attack right away. So David has no time when he first becomes king to think about anything else other than immediate survival. He fights those two battles with the Plishtim that we saw in Perek Hay. Then immediately after solidifying Yerushalayim, the very first thing that David wants to do after solidifying unified monarchy and control of Yerushalayim is bringing the Aron Kodesh to Yerushalayim, hoping to build the Beis HaMikdash. Then he's told that is not going to happen. So I'm going to suggest that it's really pretty soon after that, in the first couple of years of David's reign, once he has solidified the other kingdom, that he is looking for any of Shaul's survivors, any survivor from the house of Yehonasan. And that this parak here, parak tes, is being told to us before all of the battles we saw in the previous parak. Now, let's say one proof that they bring for that, before we ask, well, why would this be out of order, right? So at the end of the parak, we'll see that Mephibosheth has a young son. We will have to ask, why do we need to know that Mephibosheth has a young son? But the Dat Mikra claims that if we do the math, the Navi told us a little while ago that Mephibosheth was 5 years old when Shaul and Yehonasan were killed. So if he's five then, that means that after 7.5 years where David was in Hebron, Mephibosheth would be somewhere between 12 or 13 when David becomes king of the unified kingdom. Mephibosheth has a very, very young son. Sounds like he has a baby son in this parak. Dat Mikra says, we know that the custom of the royal families was to get married at a very, very young age. Truth is, it's not only a custom of the royal families. I mean, even 150 years ago, the rabbinic elite would get married at a very young age. And then the Tziv got married at like age 13 or 14, right? That was not uncommon in elite circles when you did not have to be going to work. So the Dat Mikra says if he has a very young son, it makes sense that he's getting married, he's having his first child as a teenager. So it would follow to reason that Mephibosheth in our parak is, let's say, 18, 19, 20 years old. So David has been king for a few years, just enough time for him to have solidified control of the country and pushed back the Plishtim. But it's before everything else happens. Okay. Now, if that's true, then we need to ask, why are the prakim written out of order, right? It all should have been done chronologically. For some reason, after the perek of David's conquest, we have a perek with the chesed and the fiboshes. And I think that there are two reasons to do that. One reason is we wanted last week's perek where it was. We wanted last week's perek about all the conquests specifically to be next to Nasan's prophecy about the Beis HaMikdash. Rashi said that. Rashi said the whole purpose of that parak was to tell us that David was locked in the aftermath of being told he's not going to build the Beis HaMikdash. David says, well, if I'm not going to build it, at least I can do as much as I can to prepare for building it and amass the gold and the spoils necessary for building the Beis HaMikdash. So Parak Ches belongs next to Parak Zion. Right, Parak Zion, the parak which prophesies the Beis HaMikdash Nevuah, will be next to Parak Ches, even though chronologically they're not actually next to each other. So too here, Parak Tes, the parak of Mephibosheth, we're going to see, belongs next to Parak Yud. Because the next parak, which also seems to be chronologically out of order, is going to describe David's dedication to Chesed to someone else. I had to scroll down to it for a second. It's going to describe David's chesed to Hanun, the new king of Ammon. So we're going to have two prakim back to back, which are describing chesed that David wants to do. In each case, by the way, chesed to somebody that there's a complicated backstory with, because Hanun's father Nachash tried to enslave and mutilate Jews on the other side of the Jordan River, and of course with Mephibosheth, his grandfather Shaul tried to get David killed. So we're going to have two prakim emphasizing David's chesed, and I don't think it's a coincidence that we're going to have these two prakim right before the story of David and Bathsheba. We're going to like be building up David as this amazing Baal chesed right before the story of David and Bathsheba and Uriah Hiti. Whether that's because it just makes the story even more shocking and confusing, or whether it's because that's going to help unlock part of what's going on in that story, we'll have to talk about in a couple of weeks. But for now, it's just something for us to keep in mind. We want David's chesed front and center, two back-to-back prakim of chesed before Bathsheba and Uriah, even though chronologically, this is not where the parak belongs. It makes no sense for this to have been so long after David became king. Okay, so that all is the general background to when this is happening. And why this is happening the way it is. Let's see what actually happens. So David is looking for a descendant of Jehonasan, right? Malbim explained it's because he can't find anybody because they're other fugitives. The Abarbanel throws in that David also doesn't just want to find one, he wants to promote him to a high position in the government. Why would he want to do that? Because that's exactly the promise that David had made to Jehonasan. Jehonasan and David had agreed that when David becomes king, assuming that Jehonasan survives, which was an assumption, doesn't actually happen, the dream was that Jehonasan would be the Mishneh LeMelech. Jehonasan would be the second in command. The Ramban at the end in Parshas Vayechi, when he describes the bracha of royalty that is given to Shevet Yehuda, so the Ramban there, it's quoted Hanukkah time because the Ramban argues with the Rambam. The Ramban says that the Hashmonaim, who were Kohanim, of course, made a terrible sin by assuming the throne, because the Ramban says that Kahuna is for Shevet Levi, but Malchus is for Shevet Yehuda. Kings are only supposed to be for the tribe of Yehuda. So the Ramban has to ask, well, what about Shaul from Shevet Binyamin? The Navi did say that Shaul only lost the throne because of his own sins and failures. What would have happened if Shaul hadn't failed? So the Ramban takes it up, and the Ramban says, well, maybe Shaul would have continued as like an overlord of Shevet Binyamin. And he says, his preferable explanation is that the dream would have been for the members of Shaul's family to be in the role of the Mishneh LeMelech, the second in command. That's, after all, what Yosef is to Paro. That's what Mordechai is to Ahasuerus. That's what Jehonasan was going to be to David. Binyamin is not supposed to rule long-term, But Binyamin is perfect to be the second in command, the assistant, the Mishneh LeMelech. Yehonasan cannot be that for David because he gets killed in Har Gilboa. Barbanel suggests that that's what David wants with Mephibosheth. He wants to find a descendant of Yehonasan that he can promote to a very high government position, right? So far from killing him, the way the Malvim said would be standard middle ancient and even not ancient Middle Eastern practice, David wants to find him. David wants to give him peace and security, and even wants to give him, you know, like the best job in the kingdom. Okay, so the Navi tells us that David finds there's the Beis Shaul Haya Eved Ushmo Tziva. So there's somebody named Tziva. Chazal say he's actually Eved Kanani, but there's an Eved, and we'll see. He's an Eved. It makes it sound like he's, you know, he's a lowly nobody. Sounds like he's a lowly nobody. We'll see if that's true. The Navi is going to throw a twist at us. But there's some guy Tziva who had been a servant in the house of Shaul. They bring him to David, and the king says to him, "Hata Tziva Yomer Avdacha." Yep. Are you Tziva? And he says, "Yes." Now let's read this pasuk carefully because we're going to try to get a sense of the tone of Tziva's attitude. What is Tziva's attitude towards David in these pasukim? So Navi tells us, "Vayomer HaMelech HaEfes Od Ish LeBeis Shaul VeAsim El Chesed Elokim." Is there anybody left from the house of Shaul that I want to do either the kindness of God or tremendous chesed? It's a key line, chesed elokim. So is there anybody left? He wants to know, is there anybody left? Yom Tziva Lamelech, Od Bein Yehonasan Nechei Raglein. Yehonasan has a son who's a cripple. Now what do you think of that line? I mean, he doesn't say yes. He doesn't say the son's name. All he says is, yeah, there's a son who's a cripple. Why does he have to mention he's a cripple? And why doesn't he mention his name? So you might be like wondering how enthusiastic is Tziva about this this project. Okay. The Yom Lo HaMelech Eifahu. So the king says, where is he? You know, I'm asking him for a reason. And then Tziva says in response, Yehu Beis Mechir Ben Amiel B'lo Davar. Okay, he's in the city Lo Davar, which is on the outskirts. It's on the far border of Eretz Yisrael. It's on the it's in the land of Shevet Gad, in Aver HaYarden. If Mephibosheth is a fugitive, it follows the reason that he would be going as far away as he could. And we've seen earlier that Shaul's stronghold was on the other side of the Jordan River. Right, that Machanaim was the city on the other side of the Jordan River where Ishbosheth set up his capital. Yavesh Gilad on the other side of the Jordan River were the people who rescued Shaul's body from the Plishtim. So we have Lo Devar, another city there. That's where Mephibosheth is hiding out. Tziva tells David where he is, and David goes to bring him. Okay, right. We have these three back and forths between David and Tziva, right? And none of it is really very friendly, and in none of it is Tziva particularly forthcoming. And we notice that the name Mephibosheth does not appear in the first chunk of the Psukim at all. Okay. Now, David had used this line, Chesed Elokim, right? He wants to do the Chesed of God with Mephibosheth. We need to appreciate that David is not taking that term out of nowhere. He's not taking that term out of a vacuum. He's using the exact line that Yehonasan himself had used when David and Yehonasan had made their original fateful covenant, right? Yehonasan, at least early in Parak Chaf, so he hopes to survive. This is this is after from Archa Chodesh, right? This is right before David is not going to show up at the Rosh Chodesh meal, and then Shaul is going to get furious with Yehonasan, and then Yehonasan is going to have the guy shooting the arrows. But Yehonasan in Parak Yud Gimel has, you know, maybe one of the most shocking psukim of all time, where Yehonasan says to David, again, this is as his father is still king, "Vihi Hashem imach kasher haya imavi." May God be with you as he was with my father. Yehonasan recognizes that even though his father is king, he knows full well Hashem is not with his father anymore. He openly acknowledges and admits, even though it means he's not going to be king, that Hashem has chosen David to be the Melech. And then Yonasan says to David, "If I will not live to see you become king, right? So the chesed of God, Meaning you can do the chesed of God with me, and from then around, your chesed will not be cut off from my household ad olam. Even as God cuts off David's enemies, what some of the Mefarshim say means Shaul himself. So Yonasan had used the line of the chesed of God to refer to David taking care of Yehonasan's household. And now, you know, David is coming full circle. That's exactly what he is looking, what he's looking to do. Okay, so Mephibosheth comes to David. And we need to kind of visualize the scene, right? Mephibosheth has been a fugitive. So Mephibosheth ben Yehonasan ben Shaul, right? Forgiven his whole lineage. On the one hand, he's Yehonasan's son. On the other hand, he's Shaul's grandson. So he comes to David. And it's the first time in the parak that the Navi is giving us his name. Right? So he falls down on his face and he bows down. Right? Here I am. First thing David has to tell him is, do not be afraid. I'm going to do chesed for Yonasan and your father. I'm going to return all of Shaul's lands to you. You're going to eat bread at my table forever. Okay, and Mephibosheth is kind of overcome with gratitude. Now, that's it. So we've been building up and building up. We've been building up to the chesed, right? What's the amazing chesed we're building up to? The chesed Hashem, the chesed Elohim that David's going to do. What we're given is he's going to give Mephibosheth his land back. Is that's kind of a downer, no? It's a bit underwhelming. Like, really? You know, we built it up, and then hey, you can have your grandfather's land back. So two answers to this question. The Radak asks this question. Where is it? The Radak says, well, Ma'a chesed. Like, what's the big deal? And he says a little later on, Im hayanosin lo mishalo, zaya chesed? If he's just giving Mephibosheth his own stuff back, so what is so amazing about all this? So the Radak explains that we have to remember that Mephibosheth really is suspected of being a traitor. What happens to a traitor? A traitor's lands are confiscated by the king. I mean, that's why, you know, in a little while, but when Avshalom's rebellion is about to collapse, so Achitophel, the advisor, is going to kill himself when he knows it's going to fall apart. Because if he kills himself, at least his children will inherit his estate. If you're in Mori B'Malchus, the king is entitled to take your stuff, right? That's why Achav takes the field, the vineyard from Navos, because he's convicted of rebelling against the king. So that's what the Radak explains over here. His explanation is, because Ishbosheth was a Moreh B'Malchus. For 6.5 years, 7.5 years, Ishbosheth really knew full well that David was supposed to be king. I mean, Avner told Ishbosheth that everyone knows David is supposed to be king. And yet Ishbosheth, you know, he wouldn't go along with it. I mean, Ishbosheth wouldn't do anything in his life, but he wouldn't, even after Avner left him, he wouldn't fold. He wouldn't come to an agreement with David. That renders the house of Shaul rebels against the throne. Legally, David is entitled to the entire estate. Therefore, it really was tremendously generous of David to actually give the land back to Mephibosheth. I mean, we have to wonder, like, how much land did Shaul have? Man was the king, right? It must have been fields and fields and fields. We're talking millions and millions and millions of dollars, which are being transferred to Mephibosheth. Okay, so that's what the Radak has to say. Rav Amnon Bazak, though, in the VBM, so he makes another suggestion. And I think if we think about it, we really can blend the two. Because Rav Bazak says, well, hold on a second. We need to go back to this guy, Tziva, right? This Eved from the house of Shaul, who did not seem super enthusiastic about David's plan. Now, the truth is, one way to look at Siva, we could look at him positively. He was not very enthusiastic because he was afraid about what David might do if he uncovered Mephibosheth. Okay, one problem with that is that in a little while, Siva is going to completely betray Mephibosheth in a partially successful attempt to cheat him out of all of this land. All right, but if you look at later on in the parak, so the Navi tells us something kind of astonishing about Siva. Navi just sticks it in there. Navi tells us that Siva had 15 sons and 20 servants. Now, that is not what you have if you're a regular balabas. Kal vachomer if you are an eved. That is somebody who is very wealthy. You need to be rich to have 15 kids. If you have 15 kids, 15 sons, Siva probably has multiple wives. He has 20 avadim. He is living it up. He is living like an aristocrat. How can Siva, some eved, be living so high on the hog? So Rav Bazak suggests that Siva himself, in the aftermath of the death of Shaul and the collapse of Ishbosheth, Siva had simply appropriated Shaul's land for himself. That's why he's living it up so high. That's why he's so resentful towards David, who is now bringing in Mephibosheth. And David makes a big deal in the next few seconds. He turns to Mephibosheth and to Siva, and David tells Siva, you are going to work the land, you and your sons and your servants, and you're going to bring all the produce to Mephibosheth. Why is David making such a big deal about that? Rav Bazak suggests the pshat and the psukim is that until now, Siva has been taking on land for himself. So the chesed of David is not that he is just giving land. He's not just returning land to Mephibosheth. It's that he is actively being Meshiv Aveda, right? He's going out of his way to extract land from a powerful person, making an enemy potentially, and giving that land to Mephibosheth, who he thinks should be the rightful owner. Now, Jews, we probably should wonder, like, could it be that until now, you know, like no one had any idea what about all the massive, massive tracts of land that Shaul had? We could suggest something in between, right? That much of Shaul's land had been appropriated by David, the royal estate. At the same time, in all of the tumult, so, you know, who at the IRS is keeping exact tabs on what is Shaul's land and what is not? And was it easy in the aftermath, in the upheaval of Shaul being killed, for Tziva to grab a piece of the pie for himself? And now David is aggressively going through the records and saying, hey, Tziva, I remember some of that land belonged to Shaul, and we are not just giving my land that I took back to Mephibosheth. We're going to take an intensive effort and make sure that Mephibosheth gets everything back, right? So Radak is telling us that the chesed is, he's giving Mephibosheth the ancestral lands back, or Bazak is suggesting that he's taking the land back from Mephibosheth, from Tziva, and it's also possible that both could be true simultaneously, right? Now, the other piece of chesed that David is doing is he's telling Mephibosheth, you're going to eat at my table all the time, right? And in fact, he goes even further. One place he says, this is the way Rashi understands the pasuk, is David is saying that ochel al shochani kachad mibnei hamelach. He's going to eat at my table, and he's even going to be like one of my sons, right? He's going to be like one of the sons of the king. Okay, so David is really trying to go all in. Now, there's I gotta just like vent for a second. It's okay with you. There's some of the modern commentators on Shaul, so on Shmuel. So there's one I have. I don't want to say what it is because Melech Shahara, but it's interesting. It's not written by an Orthodox Jew, and he has some very nice insights. But the overall attitude he has towards David, I gotta say, I saw a line from Rav Yaakov Migdan, which I want to talk about in a couple of weeks. But it was like, it's a great line about David. He said, when we talk about David's flaws, he says, the traditional approach of the Beis Medrash has been, we're impressed by David's tzidkus, and we struggle to understand David's failures. So it says, in the world of the academy, often it seems like, you know, in academic circles, they're impressed by David's failures and David's sins, and then they struggle to understand his tzidkus, right? It's like looking at it from the opposite perspective. So this chapter is like, what is David? Look totally cynically at this whole chapter and said that that David just wants to have Mephibosheth under his control. If he's in Yerushalayim, he'll be under surveillance. You know, I can like make sure that he's not going to try any funny business. Totally the opposite of, I think, the correct way to read the parak. But I think one way that literarily we can see what the Navi does, take a look at this, it's really cool. So why don't the Navi just, even the few psukim, shows us the sensitivity that's on display. Do we call David by his first name or by his title? Do we call David the king or do we call him David? Well, take a look. When David is talking to Tziva in the beginning of the parak, right? See, the Navi, again and again, refers to him as the Melech. When David is talking to Tziva, he is exclusively described as the Melech, right? They bring Tziva in. Vayomer ha-Melech elav ata Tziva. Vayomer ha-Melech atas, right? Vayomer ha-Melech Tziva el ha-Melech. It's all the king and Tziva. There is no personal relationship here whatsoever. You have the king and you have the Eved. The word Eved also happens to be shows up many, many times in the parak. Likewise, at the end of the parak, when David turns to Tziva the second time around and he tells Tziva that you're going to serve Mephibosheth, the son of your master, he calls him, and you're going to give him food and you're going to take care of the estate and everything. Again and again and again, David is referred to as Hamelach. He is Hamelach the whole parak, except when David speaks of Mephibosheth. And for these three psukim, where David and Mephibosheth are face-to-face, the titles go out the window, and all of a sudden it is the two names, the two people connecting again and again. Mephibosheth's name is dropped. Tziva never mentions Mephibosheth's name. He just says, there's some son who's a cripple. All of a sudden, when they come face-to-face, the Navi told us, Mephibosheth ben Yehonah son ben Shaul comes to David, falls on his face. Vayomer David, what does David say? First word of David's mouth is the name, Mephibosheth. Why do you call someone by name? You call someone by name to establish that connection to them, right? The politicians are amazing at it, is memorizing names, because that's the easiest way to start to develop that person-to-person connection. And three times in the psukim we have, right, they brought Mephibosheth to David. David says Mephibosheth. Vayomerlo David Altira. It's all David Mephibosheth, David Mephibosheth. Two people connecting man to man. The Melech goes out the window. The Melech goes out the window. It is the two of them connecting. That is the chesed of David on display. And confirming that this is what the Navi tries to do, to show us David as a man of chesed. I'm going to scroll up for a second. So we're going to look at next week. We talk about the battle that David is going to have with the people of Ammon. It also began with an episode of chesed. David wants to reciprocate the kindness that that Ammon had done to him. We have three times in one pasuk, David by name. Vayomer David asah chesed, vayishlach David lenachamo, vayavo avdei David. It's all David, David, David. It's all person, person, person. That is the chesed connection, the chesed Hashem, the chesed Elohim that David is trying to forge and David is trying to create with Mephibosheth. Now, just to close out the parak, we need to appreciate a couple of really two major points at the close of the parak. Really put a cap on this chesed and understand why this is so important. Like, it's nice in the moment. The chesed is nice. We need to appreciate what is actually happening, really happening over here. So the Navi tells us that the now he's the melech again, back in melech mode, and he turns to Tziva. And he tells him, so everything is going to go to Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth is going to be in my table. Okay, fine. Then we're told, puzzlingly, that Mephibosheth has a young son named Micha. It seems totally irrelevant to the parak. And then the parak also ends on a strange note. Mephibosheth, he's always living in Yerushalayim. So he went from being out in the boondocks to living in Yerushalayim. being at David's palace at the table every single day. V'hu piseach shtei ragla. He was lame on both of his feet. I should mention this in the beginning, but Mephibosheth is crippled. We talked this a few weeks ago. Mephibosheth is crippled because in the confusion after the death of Shaul and the loss of the battle of Hargobah, Mephibosheth's governess picks him up and runs, and he falls, and he breaks both of his legs, and they never have time to set the legs properly. So he's a cripple. The Nebi told us that in Perek Tal. Why is the closing image of Mephibosheth, who piseach shtei raglav? He was a cripple on both of his feet. We know that from earlier. We know that from Tziva. Tziva told David, oh yeah, Yonasan has a son, nechei raglav. His son is a cripple. Why the closing? There's a whole bunch of mysterious stuff at the end. We're told about a random son who's kind of irrelevant. And then we're left, it's like this beautiful, uplifting story. Why darken it by ending the parak? Oh, remember, Mephibosheth is a cripple. And not just a cripple, but a cripple in both feet. You know, not just a one-legged limp, but shtei raglav, totally crippled. Why do I need to end on such a harsh note, or such a depressing note? Right. So let's make two basic points at the end of the parak. One is, you know, we'll come back to that in a second, but if we look, there's a line which comes up again and again and again at the end of the parak. David cannot stop telling Mephibosheth. The Navi cannot stop telling us that Mephibosheth is going to eat at the king's table. Atochal lechem al shulchani tamed. You'll always eat food at my table. Right, Mephibosheth yochal tamed lachem al shulchani. He's always eating at my table. Mephibosheth ochal shulchani kachamni amal, because he's like one of my sons. Mephibosheth was in your shalim ki shulchan amal tamed hu ochal. How many times do I need to be told that Mephibosheth always ate at the king's table? Why is that so? I get it the first time, like four different times. The Nebi needs to tell that to me, that he's eating. He's always eating at the king's table. Why is that so important? I think the answer to that question really is very simple. When is the last time we saw the king's table? We saw the king's table one time previously, I think in all of Tanakh, to the best of my knowledge. There's not so much of it, just Chumash, Yeshua, Shoftim, and Shmuel. And that was that same exact parak where Yehonasan and David had made the bris, the Chesed Hashem bris between David and Yehonasan. David is supposed to come to the king's table, right, for the Rosh Chodesh meal. He doesn't show up, and Yehonasan and David had made the whole plan. And that is the place where the Navi had used the line of the Shulchan Hamelach, the king's table. David doesn't come, right? He goes, he's with his family, he's really hiding out there. And this parak was the moment where David and Shaul broke apart finally, where even Yehonasan had to admit that Shaul was never going to reconcile with David, and David has to go into hiding, and he really never ends being a fugitive until after Shaul dies. This moment right here, the last moment where we had the king's table, was the moment of the break between Shaul and David. Now, David was supposed to eat at the king's table. David was supposed to eat at the king's table like one of the B'nai HaMelech, like one of the king's sons. Why? Because David at the time is Shaul's son-in-law. So what David is doing for Mephibosheth here, he's not just bringing him back into Yerushalayim. He is not just making him rich, making him important, fulfilling the covenant that he had established with Yehonasan all those years ago. David is doing exactly to Mephibosheth what Shaul was supposed to do to David. And far from taking revenge, like the Malbim said any other king would do, David treats Mephibosheth exactly the way that he was supposed to be treated. You are going to eat, and you're going to always be welcome. Al shulchani tamid. Right? You're not going to come in one Rosh Chodesh, and then the next Rosh Chodesh, surprise, you're wanted dead or alive, and the king is throwing spears at you. You're always at the king's table, ke'achad mibnei hamelach. After so many efforts, between David and Yehonasan, and then David with Avner and Ishbosheth, and then David and Michal trying and failing and failing and failing to reconcile Beis David and Beis Shaul. So many attempts and so many failures. That Beis Hamikdash was one lifelong dream David had, and reconciliation with the world of Shaul and Yehonasan is the other dream. And that is what David's Chesed Elohim is able to pull off over here. Finally, we have the reconciliation. Yehonasan himself may not be the Mishneh LeMelech, but his son Mephibosheth is. And he, David, who is now the king, is treating Mephibosheth exactly the way that he was supposed to be treated. I think that's one the first major point for us to appreciate at the end. The second, though, point for us to really appreciate, besides David's chesed and the magnitude of it, right? The how he's trying and finally succeeding in reconnecting and reuniting with the world of Shaul. So why the cripple? Why the emphasis on him being crippled in both feet? Well, if we think, Zareya, a bunch of weeks ago, we had a shiur about Shaul. We said that Shaul's defining characteristic was that the appearances of Shaul were so deceiving, right? And in Shaul's whole world, everything was about appearances. It's about how he looks. It's about the optics. It's important that Shaul be with him. He needs the people to see him with Shmuel. He needs to build a monument for the people to see. It was all optics and vision when it came to Shaul. And the facade of the physically impressive, handsome, tall person belied the fundamental insecurities that lay beneath, which ultimately, really crippled his leadership. Is it a coincidence that the first time we're introduced to Shaul, right, he's the Bachur Batov, Mishachmo v'mala gova mikol ha'am, tallest of everybody. The last time we saw Shaul and Yehonasan referred to, David in his kinnah talked about them as the Minasharim Kalumi Arayas Gavei, right? Swift of the Eagle, strong of the lions. One could look at the grandson of Mephibosheth and say, Rahman al-Islam, look how far the house of Shaul has fallen. It's like we kicked him down enough times. One more, that the house of Shaul, who was taller than everyone else, and was, Minasharim Kalumi Arayas Gaveiru, while his one surviving grandson is a cripple who's bowing down on his face in front of David. Right? That'll be one way to think about this. This is just really depressing. But I think that's not at all the way the Navi wants us to think about the end of the parak. And why is that? What's the tell? The tell is that for some reason, the Navi thought it was important for us to know that this Mephibosheth has a young son named Micha. Who cares? Who cares about Mephibosheth's son, Micha? Mephibosheth's son, Micha, is not going to do anything in this parak. He's not going to do anything next parak. He's not going to do anything at all. We're never going to see. I don't think we're going to see Micha again. He's irrelevant. He's a little baby. Right? He's a crying baby on the corner. Who cares that there is a young son, Micha, to Mephibosheth? Why did the Navi have to give us that piece of information? I think that the reason why is that that is the tell that Mephibosheth has a future. And that this is the irony, the profound irony of the house of Shaul, is that everything, right, nothing was as it seemed. It seemed like Shaul was going to be the king, the leader, the most impressive physical specimen. You looked at Shaul, you were impressed. You looked at Yehonasan, you were impressed. Those are the warriors, those are the leaders. You look at Mephibosheth, and the impression you have, it's the dismissive attitude of Tziva, the Eved, who says, this Od Ben Nachera Glayim, there's some son who's a cripple. He's a cripple, he's nothing. He's never going to have anything. There's no hope. And yet, it's that son who's the cripple, who on the outside seems to have no future, who in reality provides the entire glorious future that still lies ahead for the house of Shaul. Because the Pesukim and Divrei Hayamim tell us, that the son, right, Riv Baal, okay, the whole story about Baal or Boshes, I think we talked about earlier, in Shmuel, they're all Boshes, and Divrei Hayamim, all the names are Baal. Well, he has the son, Micha, and then we're told about generation after generation after generation, from this little kid, Micha, from Mephibosheth, culminating in, this is around the time of Chizkiyo, the 11th generation down over here, Yubnei Ulam Anashim Giborei Chayil Dorchei Keshes Umarbim Banim Ubnei Banim Mea V'chamishim. Ultimately, we have warriors, archers, just like Yehonasan, by the way. Many, 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 many sons, right? The family proliferates and grows, all from the seed that is planted right here, the chesed that David provides for Mephibosheth. Instead of killing Mephibosheth, he brings him in, gives him security. Mephibosheth has a child, is able to raise him, and that ultimately produces this tremendous regrowth and reflowering of the house of Shaul, culminating in, you know, so we're in Chodesh Adar already, it's officially Adar, so we can say we know, Mordechai, right, who's a descendant of Shaul. Mordechai, we think of him as a descendant of Shaul, Mordechai really is a descendant of Mephibosheth. It's all thanks to the chesed that David does over here, right? So on one hand, we see the incredible chesed that David is showing. The Navi is going out of order because it wants us to think about David's chesed. We're going to back-to-back weeks about it, behaving in a way that nobody else ever would. It's very uplifting. We finally have reconciled the house of David with the house of Shaul. And then you have on the outside this cripple who seems like he has no hope and no future. But of course, you know, that was David HaMelech himself. I mean, we said hello this morning. Evan Masu Habonim, Paisan LaRosh Pina, right? The rock that everyone thinks of as disgusting turns out to be the keystone. That was David himself, the youngest of all the sons, who has any chance at defeating Goliath. But don't be confused by David's appearances. It may have confused even no less than Shmuel Hanavi. But David HaMelech was the foundation stone for the Malchus. And here we have Mephibosheth. Once again, you look out on the outside, it seems like nothing, but he is the foundation for so much more, right? Mephibosheth, the son of Yehonasan. Yehonasan and David had so much in common. And now what emerges from the end of the parak are the seeds to show us that common link between David and Yehonasan is now shared by David and the next generation, which has reconciled. All right. So that's what I've got. Thanks everyone for joining. And we're shambling forward. Next week's gonna be fine. Next week we're gonna do some conquest and Yoav and Avishai, and we're gonna really I'll be fine. And then enjoy while it lasts, though. You know, it's like the opposite of weather right now. Like right now the weather is so bad. But right now in David land, like everything is sunny and 75 degrees. So we'll enjoy that. And then we'll deal with complicated things in a couple of weeks in this show. So thanks everyone for joining, and looking forward to next time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.